This is part two of my interview with John Skeet. In part one, we talked about note of time and the C-sharp specification. In this podcast, we continue with a little bit more about C-sharp before moving on to the Google Cloud platform. Hope you enjoy. Do you have an opinion you could share on the releases of the .NET Core, which have seen significant changes from one to another with maybe different approaches even?
So going from Project K to DNX to .NET CLI, and the whole what does it mean to be on .NET Core itself, the difference between .NET Core as a platform and the .NET Core tooling. I think it's fair to say not everything has been handled as perfectly as it might be with hindsight. I would personally say that when there was the announcement that the end of February in 2016 would have the release candidate 2, which would have major tooling changes, and that would be the last release candidate, it felt like that's not something that you do, because you have a release candidate so you can get feedback and change things if you need to. And sure enough, things needed changing.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but at one point in January this year, I put about 2 weeks of time in my company into doing something in .NET Core, with the assurances from some of the Microsoft people in the Boston area that this is it, it's fixed, it's settled, it's not going to change. Now, aside from the fact that we couldn't get things working the way we wanted, it was too difficult to compile, the project.jsons were too awkward, there were too many conflicts, and there were weird errors around enumerables, and there was a significant lack of NuGet packages.
Right.
Along with all that, they then changed a lot of stuff.
So they've certainly changed a lot of the tooling. I think this is where it makes a lot of sense to differentiate between .NET Core in terms of the libraries that are available and the facilities within those. And there was quite a lot of trialing of this is what Net Standard 1.0 will be, Net Standard 1.1, 1.2, etc. The tooling has changed an awful lot, and as we know, it's going to change more to go back to CSproj, but hopefully in a nice way that makes us feel like it's still project.json to some extent. I like the fact that there will be a definitely approved comment format, for example, XML comments. One of the nasty things about early versions of project.json when it was being parsed strictly was the idea of any configuration file that you can't include comments in. That's just a non-starter for me. Later on, they did allow comments. So yes, it's certainly been, I've gone through exactly the same thing. So Note of Time started embracing project.json quite a while ago, and all my .NET work for Google is also using project.json. So I hear your pain, and I'm also using DocFX, which is a great new tool for generating API documentation, including conceptual documentation, and that's still evolving quite a lot. I think it's important to understand that there's nothing going on that didn't used to go on. It's just it used to happen behind closed doors. Maybe if you're being assured that something won't change, I would always treat that with a little bit of a pinch of salt. Until something has actually been released for 1.0, I'm never convinced that it definitely won't change. If it wasn't going to change, why isn't it already released as 1.0? You always build in the possibility of there being change there. But to be fair, they're trying to do some pretty amazing stuff with .NET Core. So, let's just start with making it full on .NET, JIT compiled on Linux and Mac. That's a big thing. And for all that I love the Mono runtime and the Mono class library, there were certainly areas where it was problematic. Ironically, with time zones, hurrah! Timezoneinfo.local was broken in 3 different ways, depending on whether you used it on Linux, Windows, or Xamarin.Android. Ignoring that for the moment, it's great to have the full support of Microsoft for .NET on all of those platforms. And then there's the whole business that I haven't looked into much yet, but the idea of bundling everything together so you have one native binary, so you know, that one file is all you need to ship, and that's got your whole application in and the CLR and the JIT compiler and you know, all the libraries that you need. That's an amazingly ambitious target. And so I'm looking forward to seeing how all that works. But yeah, I can forgive various teething issues in trying to do something so ambitious at the same time as shouting when things go wrong. And, you know, I get as frustrated as anyone else does. I'm not going to say that that I'm all flowers and light when it comes to being frustrated with, you know, you type .NET build and it just says object not set to reference or whatever the null reference exception message is with no stack trace or any indication. Oh, that means you've got to do .NET restore because magic psychic powers tell me so. There are some problems, but I'm so excited by what they're trying to achieve that I think it's great.
One little question on C# before we go on to Google Cloud Platform Services. My first awareness of you was through Stack Overflow, and we're going to come back to that a little bit later too. And I saw these questions. I was going, oh my God, John Skeet seems to answer everything. You know, how does he know so much about C#? And then a buddy of mine said that, oh, did you know that C# is not even Skeet's first language? Is that true?
Not really. So in some ways, it depends what you mean by first. So background is I learnt to program on a ZX Spectrum. So BASIC was my first language.
This is the Spectrum with the squishy keys?
Yeah. Spectrum 48K. And it came with a fantastic manual. It was sort of hundreds of pages thick and didn't just teach me programming, but I learned trigonometry from that book because we had BBC Micros at school and they had Logo. Do you remember Logo with the little turtle and, you know, forward 50?
Had the Amstrad, right? Commodores and Spectrums where I was.
Ah, right. So BBC Micros had Logo, which is... I've never actually used a proper turtle, but the idea was you were guiding this, you know, virtual robot and drawing lines. So you could draw pretty pictures with sort of programming. It really was programming. You could do loops and all kinds of things. And this was lots of fun at school. And I didn't have Logo for the Spectrum. So in my 10-year-old naivety, I thought, that's fine. I'll just write it myself. Because, hey, every 10-year-old wants to write their own implementation of a language. And because no one told me, hey, that's a stupid idea, John, you should really, you know, get some idea of what you can do, I did it. And that involved learning trigonometry, kind of badly, but, you know, well enough, from the Spectrum Basic Programming Manual. So, yeah, I have a lot to thank Spectrum for. I then learned C very badly, this time not from a manual, but from some printed tutorial that we had in a ring binder. And... let's just say my idea of code reuse was to put as much code as possible in .h files and just include them where I needed them. I had no idea of libraries. You know, it was terrible. Please never look at any C code that I've written. And then in university, I started learning Java. So I really embraced Java and did some professional Java coding back when this was 1.0. If you had a JIT compiler as a plugin, that was amazing.
What year was that? Just
that was
reference.
So 94, 95.
Okay, because I came to Java, I think, in about 98 or 9.
Right, okay. So by then, I think JIT compilers were kind of de rigueur, and things moved at a reasonable speed. But it used to be that you
should have said 98, not 89. Sorry.
Yeah, sure. that's how I heard it anyway. So yeah, I think I started learning in 94, 95. Back when I was still working in a store called Superdrug. And then I started working for Digital in vacations from sort of 95, 96, and doing Java there, which was great and very early days for Java. So if you imagine now, if you want to use LDAP from Java, obviously there's a library for it. Well, I was working for the X500 team in Digital, working on AltaVista directory. And we wanted to see what this would look like from Java. So I had to build an LDAP library, you know, that would literally do all the raw sockets and everything. ASM1BR, loads of stuff. Hideously inefficient. And then you put on the inefficiency of Java at the time. But really great experience. So to that extent, Java was my first professional programming language. When C Sharp came out, sort of, well, the beta's in 2001, I think, I picked it up immediately to toy with. And at that time, I was working for a small startup called Perimon, which sort of came out of digital when digital were bought by Compaq. Started using C Sharp more and more, started really loving it. And I sort of alternated. I was still working on Java, still working on C Sharp for some of the time. And I noticed that while I was working in Java, I would be active in the Java community, in newsgroups in particular. When I was not working in Java, I would kind of drop off JavaLang programmer, Complang Java programmer. Whereas for C Sharp, I was always interested in the C Sharp newsgroups, whether or not I was doing things for, you know, for work at the time. And I was blogging about C Sharp much more than Java. So it's always been a more attractive language to me. But I've then alternated between C Sharp and Java at various jobs since, always preferring it when I'm working in C Sharp. But for the first 7 years of working at Google, I was almost entirely working in Java. And that's fine. For whatever everyone says, Java itself is not that bad a language. It really isn't. It has things that frustrate the heck out of me, and I far prefer C Sharp, but it's really not that bad.
That's high praise from John Skeet. It's not bad.
Well, it's more high praise compared with what you would read on the net, where people would, you know, rather shoot themselves in the foot than write Java. I'm happy enough to work in Java, but I far prefer working in C Sharp, and C Sharp is where I've certainly spent a lot more time studying the language. I know my way around the JLS, the Java language specification, to some extent, you know, partly through quoting it on Stack Overflow. It's a great way of learning more about your preferred language, is to answer questions on Stack Overflow saying, why is this behaving this way? Oh, right, well, I shall consult language specification. So I know my way around Java, but not some of the details to nearly the extent that I know it for C Sharp. So I would personally say that C Sharp is my preferred and my first love as a programming language. But certainly Java was what I was using for day to day for a very long time. That's a long answer to a short question.
So we'll move on to the next major thing you're working on, the Google Cloud Platform Services for .NET. So first of all, I don't think I was fully aware. I might have been marginally aware that Google had a cloud platform. So maybe a little bit about that first.
Right. So this is something that, because I have selection bias, you know, having worked for Google for 8 years or so, obviously I know that Google has a cloud platform, and it astonishes me that other people don't know. So you know, when I think about the big three cloud platforms, I think of Amazon, AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud Platform, with AWS obviously being, I'm trying to think of the authorized way of expressing this, but AWS seems to be, in some senses, the largest. Let's leave it as vague as that.
I can say it for you if you want. I believe AWS to be leading Microsoft in many of the in many markets, but in some, I think Microsoft might be slightly ahead. And somewhere else on that list is Google.
Right. And obviously, as a Google employee, I would like to say that I would like to think that in many aspects, Google's leading the way. I think typically Google tends to drop its prices, and then strangely enough, Azure and AWS does. I think we've seen that from Google I/O before now. But in terms of anything to do with market share, I couldn't possibly comment. Anyway, the important thing is we have a cloud platform. It's awesome. You know, clearly, Google knows a thing or two about running large-scale deployments and running lots of servers in lots of data centers. I think that would be hard for anyone to deny. And we want to make our customers as successful at doing that as we are.
Is it fair to say that you came to that game kind of late, in that Amazon and Microsoft have been doing it for many, many years now? And even though you had the infrastructure and the skills, it wasn't something that Google seemed to sell to the public for a long time.
Yeah, I honestly couldn't tell you that. I don't know the dates involved. and commenting on it may be not a great idea anyway, but certainly from a position of ignorance, I'm not going to do so. Yeah, we are where we are. I think, listeners, I would encourage you to look at the history. I'm sure there are Wikipedia pages about all of them, and look at the dates there.
Do you know any of the differences of what differentiates Google's offering from AWS or Azure? And not necessarily in detail, but just, right. Is it just price? Is it otherwise comparable?
So there are so many different axes that you could compare cloud platforms on. So there are aspects of reliability. There are aspects of price. There are aspects of the services provided. So, you know, you've got sort of table stakes services around databases and raw storage, and then you've got, you know, hosting VMs, and then you've got hosting things where you don't have to manage your own VM. Obviously, I know more about the Google side of things. So we have App Engine at one end of the spectrum where you just say, you know, here's my code, please run it for me. We have App Engine Flexible Environment coming where you have a Docker image and you give that to us and say, you know, please run this for me and spin it up as many times as you need to. So that's in beta at the moment, I believe. Then we have Kubernetes, which is more, well, you'll describe your network infrastructure or the network infrastructure that you want to see. And again, it's kind of Docker-based. And then we have what's called Compute Engine at the extreme of, I will manage everything, just give me a VM. So different people will want to be somewhere on different places on that spectrum. And I suspect that AWS and Azure provide those kind of spectrum as well, but I'm certainly not going to start commenting on competitors' products. So there are some things that everyone will provide, and then some services that you know, one company will provide before others. I've been personally looking very recently at our machine learning based APIs, not ones to provide your own machine learning, but ones that take advantage of machine learning we've already done. So as an example, I've just been writing some code to make our Vision API, our Google Cloud Vision API, as easy to use as possible, where you can upload a photo and say, please tell me the landmarks and faces involved in this photo. And I'll tell you, it was such a joy. This was just yesterday that I used this for the first time. I took a photo that I'd taken while I was in Sydney for NDC Sydney, and said, right, what are the landmarks? What are the faces? And sure enough, it identified the faces. It didn't do facial recognition. It didn't say, this is your son, your eldest son, these are your twins, and this is your wife. But it said, here are the four faces with the locations in the photo, and you've got Sydney Opera House in the background. It's like, that's awesome. So I honestly don't know whether AWS and Azure expose that specific service at the moment. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I'm sure each platform provides some services that the others don't. And it's really, what do you want to use? And obviously you can use the Vision API, even if you're hosted on Azure, you can still talk to our API. The more closely hosted you are with the APIs you use, that will typically be an advantage. Just in terms of latency and things. So I think when comparing cloud platforms, there are so many things you need to compare, and a lot of them will be very specific to what you as a company are trying to do.
Yeah, it's very tricky with anything like this. Just as a trivial example, I happen to pay for an email service, a company called Fastmail, because there are certain features about it that I like, and it costs maybe $15 a year. I have a Gmail account, but hasn't got some of the things I want, so I'm willing to pay. And people go, what are you doing? Why are you paying for that? But I can see, so that sounds like a differentiating thing, having that ability. But I don't know whether that would draw developers. But to come back to your own work, you're working on .NET libraries that will allow a developer to connect to the cloud platform. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So these are libraries that you can use whether your code is running on Compute Engine or, you know, in the future when you're running .NET Core in App Engine Flex or whatever it is, or in Kubernetes, because, hey, it's just a Linux Docker container. You can use them from within Compute Engine or you can use them from your mobile application or, you know, your desktop app or whatever. One of the differentiators, or at least one of the things that people should be looking at, is how easy to use is your platform from a developer's perspective? You know, how easy is it to you to manage your deployments? How easy is it to actually just talk to storage, etc.? And my job, I see my job in two ways. One is, if you're a C# developer looking for a cloud platform, my job is to make it a no-brainer that you will come to Google Cloud Platform, because we support C# developers like no one else does. And the other job, which is slightly, I guess, cannibalistic, as a point of pride, is if you know that you're going to be on Google Cloud Platform because you know that we've got awesome availability, pricing, whatever it is that's already drawn you to Google Cloud Platform, and you're thinking, what should I code my next app in? The answer should obviously be C#, because, you know, hey, it's the best language in the world, right? We all know that. And the libraries that are provided just make it feel like no work at all to interact with all the great services we provide. So that's my job in sort of in a nutshell, those two aspects. If you're a C# dev picking a cloud, pick Google. If you're a Google Cloud dev picking a language, pick C#. If I could make every developer in the world who has to face either of those decisions pick the right option, then I'd have done my job very well.
It's an impressive goal, though, to suggest that Google will provide the best C# libraries to access a cloud, because obviously you're competing directly with Azure and Microsoft.
Yeah, and there's more to the developer experience than just the libraries used as well. So, you know, clearly we've got to interact with and integrate with the tooling where people are. So we also have, not something I'm working on personally, but a good colleague of mine is working on a Visual Studio extension, so that you can look into your cloud platform, your Google Cloud Platform presence, just as you would look into what's in Azure. We want to really make it as friendly as possible. And as you say, it's definitely a challenge. You know, Microsoft has the benefits of having both sides of that equation, as it were. But I see nothing wrong with having high goals.
All right, so we're finally going to get to Stack Overflow. I have the page open. So just for those who may or may not be aware, you have 890,582 points. Mm-hmm. You have 33,299 answers. You have asked 42 questions, and you have reached 165.4 million people.
Yeah, that last statistic is an interesting amount of double counting in there. I don't believe that.
Okay, so you've reached 88 million people, something like that. Great. What? How did this happen? Where?
So I think it was something like September the 26th, 2008, certainly late September 2008. I was reading a post by Sarah Chips, a review of C# in depth, and she referred to Stack Overflow, either in the same post or in the next post. And so I decided to check it out and looked for people referring to C# in depth on the site, and thought, hey, I can answer some of these questions. So I started answering questions. And that night or the next night, I can't remember exactly, I actually wrote a blog post saying, hey, I think this could be my next form of addiction. I can see this being a big thing. Little knowing just how big it would be. I moved from answering posts on newsgroups to answering posts on Stack Overflow. And I haven't looked recently. I used to look at the level of traffic for newsgroups, like, you know, Usenet newsgroups, and to see when Stack Overflow had eaten their lunch. And it's pretty significant for certainly some communities. Just people moving wholesale on Stack Overflow, as indeed I did. For a while, I've still posted on newsgroups, and I can't remember the last time I did.
I remember seeing a funny tweet from you. It's one that sticks out, that you were looking for an answer to something. You did a Google search. You found a Stack Overflow answer, and it happened to be your own.
Right. And sometimes, if it's a long answer, you don't necessarily know that it's your own. With 33,000 answers, I can't remember writing everything. And so before now, I've tried to upvote something and it's saying, no, you can't upvote. It's like, why can't I? Oh, it's mine. Okay. I don't remember ever wanting to downvote my own answer, which is probably a relief. But yeah, it's funny how there can be areas that you can't even remember getting stuck on before or remember seeing. But yeah, it comes back later. It's a good thing. And I've had that as well with newsgroup posts that I've referred to later on. It can be a little dangerous. There's one particular example I mentioned earlier on the backward compatibility with C#. So not many people know, but C# had versions of 1.0, which came out with .NET 1.0. And then .NET 1.1 came with C# 1.2. I don't know what happened to C# 1.1, but it's, you know, mysteriously gone. And there aren't many differences between C# 1.0 and 1.2. There's one difference that I at least was convinced of around whether or not something would be disposed, the iterator in a for each loop, whether it would be disposed. And I was convinced that this had changed. So when I was doing an abusing C# talk, I had sample code to say, you know, how can you write code to tell whether you're using the C# 2 compiler or C# 3 compiler, 3, 4, etc. And I couldn't test it, the old version, because it's really, really hard to find any way of running C# 1.0, because you've got to have something without any service packs back from the year 2000. It's pain. But I had some code that I said, I believe that this will behave one way under C# 1.0 and the other way in terms of 1.2. And I checked this, obviously not with the compiler, but by doing searches to try to find the differences. And I found a number of posts that explained carefully this precise difference. Unfortunately, all of them were written by me. So I don't have any references that aren't by me for this supposed... You know, there must be some reason why I thought it happened, but I can't verify it. And I can't disprove it. So yeah, you do need to be careful when you're the author of your own answers.
And I just see from the profile that you're active an hour ago, so you're still.
Oh yeah, I'm
searching
still
it. And...
Yep. I don't actually answer nearly as many questions as I used to. Not for want of trying, but there are relatively few questions in my niche in particular that aren't already duplicates or aren't just badly asked. I'm much pickier than I used to be about I will answer good questions. And most of my time on Stack Overflow now is spent voting to close questions that are bad and adding a comment saying, you know, you really need to improve this question so it can be reopened. Here's the kind of thing that you should do to improve your question. And sometimes that goes down well. Sometimes some question authors view that rather more negatively than they should, I think.
Before we arranged, as we had arranged the interview, I tweeted out to the general public asking if they had any questions to post to you. Mm-hmm. Of course, I got back some sarcastic answers like, isn't that what Stack Overflow is for? But I did get a few. And one was along the lines of, why do we have so many languages? And why is it that engineers will come up with new languages rather than fix deficiencies in old languages? And I think for quite some time, there was a certain stability. There was Java and there was C#. And then there was a lot of fragmentation in the JavaScript world. But now there's fragmentation everywhere from what I can see.
So I'm not sure I'd say that many developers start their own languages, at least seriously. Anders Helsberg, when he was saying, giving sort of a point system for, you know, every new feature starts at -100 and you've got to add the points up until it reaches the bar of 0 before it can get into a release. And start a new language is a -1000 bar. So you've got to really, really prove. And you know, he did to his satisfaction that he needed to come up with TypeScript. I think there's probably a lot more visibility of languages than there used to be, just because the web makes it so much easier for everyone to see each other's work. But it's true that, you know, back in the mid 90s, there was Java and C and C++. And if you did scripting, you used Perl. Do you remember Perl? Yeah.
Oh, the heck. Perl.
I never got the hang of it myself. I had Ash a friend said, who was brilliant at it,
fine.
but
Perl,
yeah.
No.
So that was before, you know, Python probably existed but wasn't widely used. So certainly scripting languages have really come on, you know, Python, Ruby and Node primarily, and obviously there will be hundreds that people will now say, why didn't you mention my favorite scripting language? And you know, Node being sort of platform, sort of JavaScript as the language. We do have the problem of fragmentation of JavaScript, which has always been a problem since JavaScript was introduced because it was implemented by different browser platforms. It feels to me like there's now better standardization of JavaScript than there used to be, although there's also JavaScript as lowest common denominator. So we have WebAssembly and we have, you know, everything compiled down to JavaScript because you know pretty much everywhere you can run JavaScript. And that's sort of unfortunate in the same way that SMTP is sort of unfortunate. Lowest common denominators tend to happen, and they're not what you would come up with if you knew it was going to end up with a lowest common denominator. Other languages like Rust and D, and to some extent Go, you know, Google didn't decide one day, hey, we'll invent a new language for the sake of it. They saw an opportunity, and I don't know to what extent it was Rob Pike originally saw the opportunity and persuaded the rest of Google. But, you know, saying we need a better systems language than C++, and so went off and worked on it for years and years. The sad thing is, from my personal point of view, I like the diversity of languages existing. I think we can learn a lot. So C-sharp designers have learned a lot from F-sharp. F-sharp tends to be more sort of cutting edge and really aimed at developers who... I'm trying to think of a way of saying this that doesn't make me sound like I think C-sharp developers are stupid. But I think F-sharp programmers tend to be more willing to learn some deep computer science than C-sharp developers necessarily are. So the C-sharp design team can sort of take some ideas that are exposed in F-sharp and say, right, well, how can we expose the same functionality, but in a way which feels more like C-sharp and is going to be easier for our community to consume? So I love the richness of having all these languages, whilst simultaneously only being able to write Java and C-sharp. You know, I can do some Python very badly. I can do some Ruby very badly. I can do some C very badly. I honestly couldn't write any F-sharp without studying tutorials again. And then when I got past the tutorial, I would write it with a heavy C-sharp accent. So I sort of welcome the idea of a polyglot programmer without being one myself. But I think it's good to have all these languages, and you know, having F-sharp and VB and C-sharp all targeting .NET as a platform and various other .NET-based languages. I think the idea of multiple languages targeting a single platform is a really powerful one. And we've seen that in the Java ecosystem as well.
It's an interesting comment you made there about how, you know, you're bad at this language or bad at that language. I interviewed Julie Lerman, and she lives in Vermont, so she's been down to conferences in Boston. I've met her a few times. And it's another interesting thing when I, as an engineer, works for a small company, I don't have books, I'm not known on Stack Overflow, and I see the likes of Julie or you or Mark Seaman, I think, oh, shit, it must all be really easy for you. But then when I meet Julie, she goes, oh, that was really tough. Or you'll say, oh, I'm really bad at this thing. It sort of means, it makes me feel, oh, okay, these people, they're good at what they do because they've learned it a lot. Maybe they have a natural talent, but it's not like it's unattainable for the rest of us.
Oh, absolutely. And one thing that constantly blows my mind is how easy it is to be called an expert in something just by knowing a little bit more than other people.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Certainly before NodeTime, I knew a bit about date and time stuff, but hardly anything. I now know far more trivia, but there are, you know, things like leap seconds are still well beyond me, so we don't handle those in NodeTime. And you know, Julie has the advantage of being much smarter than me, and likewise Mark. But yeah, no one's going to find things much, much easier. And if you need to learn something, you need to learn something. What you can do is have a more structured way of learning things. So one problem that I see a lot is people saying, I'm new to C#, so I thought I would write a website using ASP.NET Core and nhibernate to talk to a database. It's like, you're really in a world of pain there, not because any one of those things is bad in itself, but if you don't know how to declare a variable, and yet you need to cope with a leaky abstraction of link going to SQL via nhibernate and deploy it via preview level tools, you're never going to make any progress. So I'm a big, big fan of console applications. If I need to learn anything that doesn't necessarily involve a GUI, I won't use a GUI. And the Vision API that I mentioned earlier on is a great example of that. I could have written a fancy WinForms WPF GUI that would load an image and show you the image and then make the call and then highlight where on the photo the images were. That would have taken a couple of hours probably. You know, I'm not very good on WinForms. I would have to relearn a load of stuff, likewise WPF. I was able to knock up a quick console app to just dump the text of saying, well, the bounding box is, you know, this XY coordinate, etc., and then bring up the photo in paint.net and say, oh yeah, that looks like it corresponds to these rectangle bits. And that's great, because I was learning about one thing at a time, which was the Vision API, and nothing else had any friction whatsoever. So yeah, I see this all the time on Stack Overflow, people saying, I'm writing an ASP.NET app and I'm having trouble serializing this object to JSON. And so they tag it with ASP.NET as well as JSON.NET. It's like, okay, come up with an example that shows the problem. And to do that, you don't have to be in a web page. Believe me, you really, really don't. Just come up with your model, and you can have that without any interaction with ASP.NET at all. And chances are, in writing that minimal example as a console app that doesn't have any GUI nonsense, and you know, if you are going to run it in Visual Studio, then you can just launch it as a console app. You don't need to bring up a browser as well. You can just debug straight into it. Chances are, when you're coming up with that example, you'll find the problem, or you'll be able to address the problem yourself more easily. So that's my big urge to people, is really, if you're learning something, learn that one thing at a time. And if you have a problem with something, try to whittle that down to just that one problem and make everything else as trivial as possible.
I completely agree. When I write blog posts about bits and pieces, if it's not specifically Web API or MVC related, it's going to be a console app, because you can just F10 into it and off you go. I have a friend who's trying to learn Python at the moment, and I was helping her with it. And so this person's at the point of learning how to call methods and declare variables, but the piece of code they were working with was going to call a web service to get some JSON to then parse it.
Yep.
And sort of, no. Let's just learn how to call one method from another, and maybe we'll pass some variables. And, you know, because whenever I talk to people about learning programming, I say to them, there's really only a few things. You've got variables where you store stuff. You've got conditionals where you compare things, and you've got loops. And yeah, you've got methods, and you've got classes, and you've got all those bits and pieces. But if you can get storing stuff in memory, looping over it, and doing conditionals, you've got programming.
And so it's nice to have examples of that so that you can help to teach other people or help to learn a new language. So one thing I love to use as a good way of checking that kind of thing is do a simple guessing game. So the computer will generate a random number from 0 to 100, and you have 5 guesses. And after each guess, it will say higher or lower. And that's interesting enough for a child that can produce that game from, they started with nothing and they've got something that does this interactive guessing. And yet to do that, you've still got to do console input and random number generation and console output. But those are three relatively simple things. And I find that a great example that uses quite a lot of the concepts in programming, but without having to do crazy database stuff and whatever.
No. Other question from actually from a friend of mine. I told him I was interviewing you, and he was wondering how you divide your time. So obviously you have a full-time job. You've got books you write, you attend conferences, mm-hmm. you've got Stack Overflow, you have a family, you have a life.
Right. So I'm pretty good at work-life balance if you view work as my work for Google. Arguably, I'm potentially worse at it when I'm working from home. So when I work from home, I still get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was in my shed at 6:30 this morning, and I have a meeting from 6 till 7 tonight. On the other hand, after we finish this recording, I'm probably going to go to IKEA with the rest of my family. So I try to sort of balance things out, but I'm definitely not a stay in the office for 15 hours a day kind of person. On the other hand, I spend a lot of the time that I'm not doing work for Google, doing other things like NodaTime, and speaking at conferences. And the great thing about now working on C# within Google, I can go to conferences and present my work, and you know, I get to do that without taking time off, which is fantastic. And I do have other responsibilities, so I'm very active in our local church. I'm a Methodist local preacher and was a steward in the church, and you know, various things that take a lot of time. And I think it's mostly a matter of prioritizing things, learning to say no. That would be a good thing to good skill to have if I could, but make sure that you enjoy what you do. If you enjoy your work, then it doesn't feel as much like work. If you have external commitments that you really don't enjoy and aren't beneficial, you know, there can be stuff that you do that is work and boring but achieve something. So I'm also the treasurer for our local Women's Equality Party. The Women's Equality Party is a new UK political party trying to help with help fight sexism, basically. I won't go into the details now, but look us up. So I'm the local treasurer, so I've got to fill in a load of bank forms and whatever. And that's not fun. No one likes filling in bank forms, but I feel it, you know, it does something beneficial. So make sure that everything you do, there was, I can't remember whose quote saying, don't have anything in your house that you don't know to be useful or believe to be beautiful. Well, don't do anything that you don't know to be enjoyable or believe to be beneficial to the world. And take some time for yourself. So my wife and I, you know, we're in our 40s, early 40s, and most evenings we will slump in front of the TV for 3/4 of an hour or an hour. And, you know, it used to be that we didn't do that. We were much more active and go-getter type things. But yeah, you need some downtime. So don't be afraid to say no to that conference and instead just sit down and play Plants vs. Zombies for a while.
Any final notes before we wrap up for this morning afternoon?
I don't think so. No, I'd encourage, if you're a .NET developer and you're looking at date time stuff, you're probably doing it wrong through no fault of your own. Come and use NodaTime instead.
I know I am now.
It's always good to plug that. Other than that, thank you for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been a pleasure. John Skeet, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Oh.
If you make my prayers, take them out to sea.
The opening music was A Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Waves by Ayla Nerio from the album Code of Flowers.